request?
Actually, the requests do typically come through a third party, often through either the attorney's office for litigation requests or through a public records request that I understand informs the office.
So you would never pull documents off the server without coordinating with the office that actually is immediately impacted?
Correct.
And do you keep a list somewhere of all the public records requests on an ongoing basis?
I believe the ones that we do process, we collect. The ones that we're doing electronically, we do have a list of those requests.
And is there any reason why that would not be shared with commissioners on a weekly or monthly basis, just the list of what the public records requests are, so we get a flavor of A, what's being asked for, and B, so we also do our due diligence in case we have any dog in that fight?
I can't see any reason why we wouldn't do that.
I'd like to make that request because you hear anecdotally about these requests.
You have to fill out a form.
But I think on some periodic basis, letting offices know what the pending requests are is helpful and educates us about the kinds of public requests, kinds of requests from the media and citizens that are coming in.
I think that's a great idea. And also, I think it would be good to let you know that which requests we're providing today that are through self-service tools as well.
Good. Thank you.
Well, you need to understand a lot of people will request, and then when they get the price tag, won't follow through. That's one of the difficulties that they face in getting access to our records is that the cost for BTS to custom search for them can be very, very high. And that's another thing that the courts, I think, are getting less tolerant of is the charges for extraordinary searches. Let me talk a little bit about the ordinance again and the context. From our standpoint, just talking about the need for records retention isn't enough. That writing city policies and telling city employees and personnel what to do isn't enough either, and that we really need to provide the tools and the training to help everyone comply with it. And that's something that we've partnered with the bureaus to work on. About 8 years ago, my office partnered with Bureau of Technology Services and others to do an RFP and select a records management system. And we selected Tower Trim Software, known as eFiles. Within that framework, we put the state's retention schedule into the e-file system to comply with the retention requirements, and we've been installing it around various bureaus in the city. And right now, numerous bureaus are using it either, you know, selectively on particular responsibilities or throughout the bureau. The Police Bureau, Bureau of Environmental Services, Human Resources, and Purchasing all have Tower Trim, and actually most of your offices have the Tower Trim software on your desktops. We had gone through and done all five council offices. We are scheduling those with the new TUIST commissioners to make sure that your staff have the software and are trained on how to preserve the emails that you receive. Because if there's the richest source of permanent records in the city is in this building within your offices, that those communications you have with the public, those policy issues are things that need to be kept permanently, which is a very long time. So what I'd like to do is also talk about some of the advantages that come from this software. The software not only does records retention, but it also has some workflow and other advantages to it that can actually benefit the bureaus. So I'd like to introduce Officer Todd Hussey and Mark Elwood. Mark Elwood is a manager from BTS that's been assigned to the Police Bureau, and he's done some pretty remarkable things with customizing our program to serve their needs. So I'm going to turn it over to them so they can kind of give you a real-world sense of how this works.
Good morning. I'm Mark Elwood. I'm here to tell you a little bit about the TRIM system, or e-files, in the Police Bureau. Historically, the document management system was needed as part of the original field reporting system that was being built a few years ago. Because the reports generated by the system were no longer going to be paper but digital in nature, the TRIM system was purchased in 2006 in part because of the successful implementation of e-files in the city auditor's office. The TRIM system, as used at police, was able to use the same document retention schedules as e-files and provide robust security and redaction features that are useful in the records department or division. We also knew that they had the capability to, or it has the capability to archive GroupWise and exchange emails in the future if that was ever needed, so that was an important feature that we considered. Since January of 2007, all case reports and associated documents have either been scanned or imported directly into the system. The Portland Police Bureau members are able to use the system to access case reports online using an internally developed program known as RView, which is what Officer Hussey is going to talk about. This year, the Bureau began deploying an improved version of the electronic field reporting system that allows reports not only to be entered online, including on mobile data computers, but also to allow segments of or sergeants to electronically approve reports and immediately make them accessible online through RView. In addition, we are working with Multnomah County to make RView available to other law enforcement agencies such as the District Attorney's Office, the Sheriff's Office, and Community Justice. The use of TRIM is set to expand again this year at PBB to start managing documents in fiscal training and the personnel division. So it's expanding its use. I'd like to turn it over to Officer Hussey to talk about RView and his work.
Good morning. I've been asked to come and talk to you about how the RView program works for us out in the field. Excuse me. So the RView program itself is something that we use to access the reports that are kept up at records. It's a self-service process that we use now. We don't have to make those requests personally or directly with the records people. We can do that without any delay. We have access to it over the desktop PCs in a precinct or over the mobile computers in our cars now. The records division no longer has to access those for us. We're able to actually look at them right out into the field. We can make our own copies if those are necessary. Those can go into case files for additional or future reports that are written, and we were able to print them all out ourselves. The old process they had for the reporting, typically it would have been handwritten. It would have been couriered down to the records division from each of the precincts. They are set in stacks where they're waiting to be placed into files after they're processed. If an officer needed to find out something that was in a report, they would have to make a call down to the records division, let them know that they think there is a report somewhere. The records people would have to find that report, and if it had yet to be filed in one of the stacks that was waiting to be processed, they'd pull that report out for you. You may ask them to read the narrative from that report to you over the telephone or fax a copy of that report to you if it was needed to go into a future report file that you were going to be handling. And if you needed that, they would either have to fax a copy of it to you at the precinct where you were at or send it to you by courier back out to the precinct in the next trip out. The RView program itself is pretty simple for us to find things now. There's a lot of different ways to pull this information out. We can search it by the case number if we know that. We can search it by people's names. We can find reports by addresses that have been written. So there's many different things for us to look up. One of the scenarios that is a pretty common deal, when a stolen car report is made, many times there's a story that goes with cars that are stolen. So the officer will go out, take the report, submit that to the records division. As a patrol officer finds a stolen car driving around, they pull them over. We have the people in custody. Well, of course, the people in the car have their story about how they got it, too. So in the past, we weren't able to get into the whole what happened, what are the circumstances around this until we got back to the precinct, got copies of the reports, or found out what was in it. Now, in real time, we're able to access that report on our computer in the car, read the narrative that the victim has told the officer what the situation was, and we're able to actually discuss with the people who are in the car what the circumstances are. Able to make copies of that report, which is needed to submit to the district attorney, and we're able to do all of that without even bothering the records people. So it's a very user-friendly and quick system for us.
And how long have you been using the new system?
The new system has, the RView program itself has been a couple of years, I believe, that we've had access to that. The new reporting program and stuff has been in demo and is going live as we speak.
We just got done deploying the rest of the mobile data computers in the cars, so that's a fairly recent capability.
Very impressive.
Thank you, Todd. Mark? Let me just close up. Let me hit the key points, and then if you have any other questions. First of all, the rules and expectations about records, and especially electronic records, are changing. The Secretary of State's office is circulating new draft rules that will force every jurisdiction to manage its electronic records much more carefully and methodically. City policies and practices and desktop technologies need to comply with current and proposed requirements, and many of the rules are already in place, but we did find gaps and inconsistencies, which is what we're proposing to you in this code change. And we've worked with in developing those, we worked with the City Attorney's Office, Bureau of Technology Services, Office of Management and Finance, and other bureaus to review the current code and policies and rules for completeness. So what we hope is that the ordinance before you will make improvements. And we'll also be working with the Bureau of Human Resources to update administrative work rules where necessary. Beyond the rules, we also want to make it easier for city employees to comply with them and to take advantage of the benefits. So the city already owns the operational software, and it's really a matter of buying more individual licenses and installing them on desktops. Currently, the TRIM e-files are being used throughout the city. We're working with the EBS project, which is our accounting system, to put all the contracts into the e-file system, and it will track along so that everyone sees the same contract as it goes through its approval process. We now have about 1,250 tower TRIM licenses for the city of Portland, and we're looking to install them in other bureaus. We'll be working with accounting around the EBS system and Bureau of Planning and Sustainability as we can in the coming year. But, you know, finally, what I like to say is proper management of our electronic records contributes to our sustainability goals. In the past year alone, city employees and members of the public have used the self-service web interface to our record system to view 70,000 ordinances, photographs, and other historical city records that in the past would have been copied and mailed to them. Without the TRIM e-files electronic repository, every email classified as permanent, which includes many that come from your offices, would need to be printed out on paper and boxed up and preserved in the temperature and humidity-controlled area of our archive system. So the ordinance before you applies the same archival and paper records management principles we've used for years, but what we've done is expanded the universe of oversight to include documents and email in electronic form. These policies, combined with the use of existing technology and employee training, will ensure the city records continue to be preserved in a way that meets our compliance, security, public access, and sustainability goals. Are there any questions?
Conversation from council. Thank you all very much. Really appreciate your good work on this and your commitment to keeping us with the spirit and the letter of the law. This is a non-emergency, so it moves to second reading next week. Carla, can you please call the first regular agenda item? Actually, why don't you read the titles for council items 312 and 313.
Okay. 312, authorized contract with Wells Fargo Merchant Services, LLC, for merchant bank card services. 313, authorized contract with Wells Fargo, N.A. for general banking and treasury management services.
Thank you and good morning, Mayor. Well, Mayor's not here. Members of council, for the record, I'm David Thurman, the city treasurer. Items 312 and 313 on the agenda will authorize contracts with Wells Fargo Merchant Services as well as Wells Fargo Bank for basically general banking and merchant bank card services, which really encompasses a wide variety of services, your checking, your payroll deposit, as well as the bank card services that the bureaus rely upon. These contracts will be authorized through March 2013, and they're the culmination of an RFP process that was conducted last year, in which we received actually four proposals. The proposals were reviewed by an evaluation committee, and interviews were conducted.
Which four proposals?
We received a proposal from Wells Fargo, Bank of America, KeyBank, and U.S. Bank. As I said, the proposals were reviewed. We had interviews, and Wells Fargo was selected as they were the provider that way that was really able to provide us the best fit technical solution at the best price. The proposed contracts will be at an estimated cost of approximately $22,000 to $28,000 a month, and that really encompasses the banking services as well as the processing costs that go to the bank. In addition to those costs, there are the pass-through costs for credit card services that I'm sure all of you are aware of that go to Visa, MasterCard. Those range between 1% and 3% on average citywide, but those costs are consistent no matter which bank you happen to choose. Both of those segments of cost vary depending upon the city's monthly transaction activity, depending if it's high peak times or lower peak times. So it's safe to say that these are services that are basically utilized by every bureau throughout the city and are fairly critical to the ongoing business operation. So with that, I'd be happy to take any questions.
Is there a reason why more of the locally owned banks didn't respond to the RFP?
Because of the size and the volume of the city's account. I mean, we run in excess of about 50,000 to 60,000 checks per month, twice that in electronic transactions. It's a high volume, high intensity account. And quite frankly, our account in some cases are bigger than the banks that would be proposing. So it's one of those issues where in order to meet the qualifications, you really need to be a pretty large, fairly robust bank.
Conversation from council? Thank you very much.
These
are emergency items. Does anyone wishes to testify on items 312 or 313? All right. Carla, would you please call the roll?
Fritz?
I appreciate the question about the local banks and the due diligence, and also recognize that Wells Fargo is reducing their pricing as part of this contract, so it looks like the negotiations went well. Aye. Thank you.
Fish?
Aye.
Saltzman?
Good work.
Aye.
Leonard?
Aye.
Adams?
Gives me an opportunity to publicly thank you for your great ongoing work on our behalf. Thanks. Aye. 313.
Fritz?
Aye.
Fish?
Aye.
Saltzman?
Aye.
Leonard?
Aye.
Adams?
Aye. It's approved. Could you please? Oh, I need to make a motion per council ordinance that the council will meet in the evening on April 20th. So I move that motion. Everyone is supposed to have had this checked out. And everyone...
Well, I have an excused absence.
Oh, you do?
Yes.
Oh.
April 20th or May
20th? May 20th.
May 20th, I'll be here.
Sorry, May 20th. I make a motion that we have an evening council meeting May 20th.
May I ask what items will be on the agenda?
Volunteers in action.
Vision into action.
Vision into action. That I know of.
We also had a request yesterday from the citywide land use chairs to hold the permit center consolidation program in hearing in the evening. I think everybody received that email.
My understanding is that I just make the motion on the evening meeting, and then it's up to the commissioners in charge to decide whether they
May 20th won't work for that.
That's what I'm saying. I think it might be too late to go to May 20th. I know. It's really challenging.
Well, I'm not going to do that on the fly here. I mean, we need to analyze.
Right. I thought this was all worked out with folks. So I withdraw my motion, and...
she's talking about a separate issue.
Separate issue.
Yeah, so you don't need to withdraw your motion if you want to do vision into action. Hearing May 20th is fine. Amanda's, Commissioner Fritz is addressing the consolidation.
Right.
Some have asked that to be, but that the 20th won't work anyway.
Okay, so my motion is that we have a council meeting in the evening starting at 6 o'clock, and that...
Second.
Thank goodness. Any discussion of this item? Anyone wishes to testify on this item? Council, Carla, will you please call the roll on this motion?
Fritz?
Aye.
Fish?
Aye.
Saltzman?
Aye.
Leonard?
Aye.
Adams?
So I move that we have an evening hearing for the permit center consolidation whenever that can be arranged.
have a feeling in a review of the ordinance that we have to have a specific date proposed for the evening.
I'm not prepared to support any such motion until I look at the report when it's due and what's possible.
So if I could ask of you to come back with a specific date for a motion, because I think that's the way the ordinance is written.
Yes.
Mayor, I can review that at the break and let you know. I don't know the answer.
So we might be able to come back this afternoon with something.
Okay.
Thank you.
Let's plow forward. Could you please read the title for Council Calendar Item 314?
Authorize three-year term, $4,200,000 flexible service contracts for consulting services for City Enterprise Resource Planning System, post-implementation production, maintenance, and management support.
Mr. Rust.
Good morning, Council, and Mayor Adams. For the record, I'm Ken Rust, the Chief Administrative Officer, the Director of the Office of Management and Finance, and with me this morning is a face you probably haven't seen. That's because he's always very busy up on the 14th floor of the Portland building. This is Bruce Tyer. He is the project manager for the city's side of the Enterprise Business Solution Project. And we're here today to talk to you about a flexible services contract that we are seeking council authorization. As you know, we are in the midst of the implementation of our SAP application. We went live with Philo in November, and we're working on the implementation of the HCM elements as well. And as part of that project, we are seeking what we call post-production support to have available to us consultants that can help us with the implementation or the post-go-live implementation and continued support of this particular application. This is a very new product for us, and we've learned a lot in the implementation process, but we have learned from others who have implemented that it's a best practice to have some type of support available in the areas of the finance area, the human capital management area, and also in the technical area. So what we've done is we've gone through a competitive selection process, soliciting qualifications from firms that are able to provide this support to us. We had over 31 different proposals from 14 different firms in these particular functional areas. We have selected six firms that we would like to or six contracts with five different firms that we would like to negotiate a contract with for flexible services. One of those is a Northwest-based firm with a local branch here in Portland, and three of the five firms are MWESB certified by the state of Oregon. Our expectation in terms of the project cost is that in year one we would spend about $1.4 million if necessary. We expect to budget and pay for that out of the EBS project budget, and we have it set up that we can renew those contracts for two additional years each year annually in that same dollar amount, but we're not certain that we will need that much support. Really, what this is all about is providing knowledge transfer to our staff as we run and operate the SAP system, and we expect that over time we will need less and less of that support as we become more and more comfortable with the system operation. But we do know that we're going to need some continuing support as we go into the post-go-live phases of the project. Again, we will only use what we need when we need it. We're not obligated to use it if we don't need it. Our goal is to learn how to use this system with the team that we will have in place to run the SAP application, and over time we expect to need less and less of this. And if you have any other specific questions, Bruce can talk to you about how it will be used on the project.
Questions from council?
Ken, I have great confidence in your management of this whole process, but I just want to make sure I understand the fiscal impact of this request. This would be an additional $3 million?
Actually, in year one, it's an additional $1.4 million we expect, but it's budgeted to be paid for from the current budget of the EBS project. So right now, in year one, this particular contract doesn't have any impact.
But beyond that, there would be a $3 million hit over about 8 years?
No, it would be as much as $1.4 million per year for the next 2 years after next. If we need that much, and that would be something that we'd have to work with bureaus on the ongoing EBS budget, which we have in place to support the application over time.
So I just want to put the human face on this, because if you do draw down on the 1.4 mm-hmm. times 2, which is $3 million, and then it's financed, which I take it it would be paid over time, there would be the cost would be distributed among the bureaus, correct?
Right. And Commissioner, there may be a little bit of confusion because we have a couple different things going on at the same time with respect to this project. One is this particular contract, which has been in the works for some time. And the second is an item that we've talked with your council offices about, regarding what we think is a necessary reset of the HCM go-live date, the expected cost for that, and the way in which we will pay for it. So they're kind of separate
items.
Separate
those items. Yes. Okay, fine.
But your point is valid, that it's $1.4 million out of general fund budget or all the Bureau's budget. So my question is, how much of that do you think the OMF can absorb rather than passing on to the other Bureaus in years two and three?
We would have to look at the overall budget for the EBS ongoing support. It's really very early for us to know exactly the right level of that support. I mean, we aren't even fully live with all of the applications. So we have a current plan for EBS operating support that we think reflects what it's going to take to run the system effectively based on our experience talking with other governments that run the kind of application that we're running. There's possibility that we can use less of these resources and can reduce those costs, and that's what we'll be looking to do. Also, as we go through and beyond year one, we fully expect that we will know more about how to run and operate the system ourselves, so that $1.4 million first-year costs should be less, because as we use the system more and more, the need to call on consultants to help us fix certain things or to advise us on how best to use the system, that should diminish as the knowledge transfer comes into the city. So we'll be looking at those things, Commissioner, to try to figure out how we can reduce that cost and minimize impacts to bureaus.
Are you coming back to us on the other EBS issue?
Yes.
Okay. And for me, we're obviously in the middle of budget season, and we're looking at how to fill holes in our own budgets. So building on Commissioner Fritz's point, just at the earliest possible time, having a clear sense of the possible hit to each bureau. I have as you know, as the Parks Commissioner, the third largest general fund bureau, so these things have a disproportionate impact, let's say, on parks, and I want to just make sure I quantify.
Spread across all bureaus.
Yeah, Commissioner, I'm very mindful of the budget impacts.
It's spread across, but the numbers to parks are quite high. You know, the numbers that we would impact us are pretty significant.
As well as transportation.
My goal is to take whatever the costs are, reduce them as much as possible by looking very hard at our own costs and crunching the consultants on their costs to get that number down as small as possible, look at ways in which we can spread that cost to try to attenuate the impact,
yeah,
and for other ways in which we can take it as low as possible. That's what we've done with this project. When we've had other budget issues, we will continue to do that. I understand the impact.
And again, the mayor is correct, but I'll just put it in context. A $3 million EBS cost financed over 8 years would be an additional $6,000 a year for 8 years to BHCD, which is a relatively small bureau, but $34,000 a year for 8 years to parks. Now, that's not an insignificant amount for us to capture. But again, I go back to my earlier point that I have great confidence in your management of this project.
Thank you, Commissioner.
Well, I think that, one, we've established an outside expert panel for this project, and they've been meeting with staff. And so as we effectuate this phase of the effort, I want to make sure that they review utilization of this flexible service contract. And then also, I think, coming back for regular sort of reports to council on a biennial basis of how we're doing in terms of getting staff trained so the need for this goes down is something that I think the council would be well served to have happen as well.
Certainly.
Any other discussion with council? All right. Has anyone signed up to testify on council calendar item 314?
All right. No one signed up.
Anyone wishes to testify? This is an emergency. Please call the roll.
Fritz?
We've just been doing a lot of budget meetings at which financial planning has said to other bureaus, when there are cost overruns, you need to find it within your existing budget. So obviously $1.4 million per year in two and three is a lot to find within the OMF budget. But I will be once, this is our only chance, since this is a binding contract, this is our only chance to say that I'm very concerned about the impact on the other bureaus over the two and three. And so I'm hoping that you will be able to find additional savings within OMF to take a disproportionate share of these burdens, because I don't think it clearly has to be done, and we have to have these contracts, and you've done a good job of getting the contract. It is going to be an additional hit, and I'm concerned about that, but I vote aye.
Fish?
Thanks, Ken. I look forward later to talking about the EBS matter. Aye.
Saltzman?
Aye.
Leonard?
Aye.
Adams?
Aye. 314 is approved. Could you please call the roll for, or read the title and then call the roll for Council Calendar Item 315?
Grant a franchise to Northwest Natural Gas Company for a period of 20 years. Fritz?
Well, thanks again to Commissioner Saltzman for his leadership of the Office of Cable and Communication and Franchise Management during the preparation of this franchise agreement, which settles something dating back to 1859. And therefore, it's really great that we've got it done. And good work, Office of Cable Communication and Franchise Management. Aye.
Fish?
Aye.
Saltzman?
Aye.
Leonard?
Aye.
Adams?
Aye. Item 315 is approved. Could you please read the title for Council Calendar Item 316?
Amend a grant to the Lower Columbia River Estuary Partnership to investigate the presence of salmonoids at selected shallow water sites in the vicinity of the confluence of the Willamette and Columbia Rivers.
Commissioner Saltzman.
Thank you, Mayor. This is a partnership with the Lower Columbia River Estuary Partnership. Continues research on fish habitats in the Willamette and Columbia Rivers. The type of study is part of the Portland Watershed Management Plan, and we'll extend our knowledge of watershed health, including Endangered Species Act, listed salmon, and steelhead.
Any questions from council, discussion from council? Is there anyone here that wishes to testify on Council Calendar Item 316? Carla, will you please call the roll?
Fritz?
Aye.
Fish?
Aye.
Saltzman?
Aye.
Adams?
I hope you find the salmonoids. Aye. Item 316 is approved. Could you please read the title for Council Calendar Item 317?
Authorize a contract preliminary excavation and grading of site for Powell Butte Reservoir 2.
Mr. Schaff, welcome to the City Council.
Thank you.
What can you tell us about this?
Good morning. I'm David Schaff. I'm the director of the Portland Water Bureau, and I do have backup if I need it, but I'm going alone for the time being. We are here seeking approval to proceed on the first phase of the construction of what we call Powell Butte Number 2. The Portland Water Bureau purchased Powell Butte property in 1925 originally for regional water supply. Additional parcels have been added since the original purchase, so that now the city owns most of Powell Butte. The first buried reservoir was built in 1980, making Powell Butte the de facto hub of our water distribution system. The first Powell Butte master plan, showing an additional four reservoirs on Powell Butte, was done in 1985. They include three 50-million-gallon reservoirs at the 530-foot elevation and one 20-million-gallon reservoir at the 600-foot elevation. The current conditional use master plan was started in 1995 and was approved in 2003. These two volumes I have here reflect only a tiny portion of the work and the effort that went into the conditional use master plan. This master plan includes the second 50-million-gallon reservoir, the piping and appurtenances that go with it, the overflow structure, caretaker's house, small parking lot improvements, maintenance and storage facility, restroom remodel, and a small interpretive center where the existing storage facility is located. These are all included in the current project, and they will be built in the second phase of the project when we begin construction of the actual reservoir. The master plan also included a 20-million-gallon reservoir at the 600-foot elevation, a pump station to raise the water to the reservoir, and additional transmission piping to increase service areas to the south. Those are not included in the current project. The current conditional use master plan is valid through 2013. This is a project that has had extensive public involvement. Preparation of the approved master plan included an extensive public involvement process, including representatives from various city bureaus, commissioner's offices, neighborhood associations, schools, environmental organizations, recreational interests, and water districts. The master plan also reflects input from the general public at several open houses and from meetings with neighborhood associations representing areas around Powell Butte. This process started in 1995, and it continues through the current project. As part of the implementation plan, the Water Bureau and Parks Bureau prepared a public outreach plan that focuses on specific public outreach meetings and activities. The purpose of the plan is to maintain communications with our local citizens and the general public. Many of the strategies defined in this plan will continue to be conducted throughout the construction period. We anticipate being done 2013. Key audiences include Friends of Powell Butte, Community Residents, Centennial Neighborhood Association, Powellhurst Gilbert Neighborhood Association, Pleasant Valley Neighborhood Association, Powell Butte Heights Homeowners Association, Meadowland Park, Meadow Crest Farm Estates, Mobile Home Community, Portland Public Schools, park users, special interest groups such as the 40 Mile Loop Land Trust, Friends of Springwater, Johnson Creek, and Pump, affected local businesses, the general public, and then other governmental agencies. We include Commissioners Hale, Lindbergh, Sten in this list, going all the way back to 1995, and of course, Commissioner Saltzman and Commissioner Leonard. So in the last few years, in 2005 to 2007, we worked with the Powell Butte Drainage Study Work Group. We convened a special group to work on of community representatives familiar with the park and its stormwater issues. In August 2006, we worked with Friends of Powell Butte and Pump on trail modification projects for bikes. In October of 2006, we worked on the Powell Butte Risk Reduction Project. It was a Citizens Advisory Committee working on a plan to reduce the risk of wildfires within the park. 2006-07, we were working with the Pleasant Valley Neighborhood Association and the Friends of the Powell Butte on plans to install a precast concrete modular vault to house and bring existing water quality monitoring equipment and instrumentation above ground. The Friends provided input into the appearance of the structure and recommended its color. From 2003 to 2009, water and park staff have met and continue to meet monthly with Friends of Powell Butte and their subcommittees to discuss concerns, issues, upcoming works, wishes, desires, etc. During that same period, parks and water have continued to meet monthly to discuss our overall coordination and management issues for the Butte. That includes David Peters, Tim Hall, Tom Klutz, our property manager, Rich Rice, our grounds manager, Kevin Duff, the caretaker at Powell Butte, and Teresa Elliott. All those folks work with Parks and Water Bureau and the Friends of Powell Butte. Public involvement for the construction project starting this year. We have a database mailing list that we've compiled that includes immediately affected neighbors, special interest groups, neighborhood community leaders. We sent out an introductory letter in September regarding the project. We've had pre-planning meetings with both the Water Bureau and Park staff with key stakeholders and opinion leaders to discuss the level of engagement, review our outreach plan, collect input on the public outreach and involvement strategy. We've had community meetings. We've met with community opinion leaders. We've had public meetings. We hosted a public presentation in November at Harold Oliver School. I was at that meeting as well. We've posted information on our city calendar, the public bulletin, and at the Powell Butte information kiosk. We mailed a notification of the meeting to approximately 7,000 people, including all the property owners within at least 150 feet of the property. We're planning another public meeting in April. We've met with public environmental interest groups, the Johnson Creek Watershed Council, to provide information on the steps what we and BES are taking for erosion control. We've worked with the manufactured home park residents who are concerned about stormwater runoff. We've scheduled a stop and talk presentation to the residents in March of 2009. And we've been working with trying to get a meeting with the Powell Butte Heights Homeowners Association. We had one, but it was scheduled during the bad weather. It got canceled and we're rescheduling it. We also have created a web page for this project and we have brochures and handouts. Upcoming, we are working with identifying local trail users to provide input on the relocation of trails through a separate trail planning process. We've determined what businesses will be directly and indirectly affected by construction. We're identifying opportunities and challenges there. We're hosting stop and talk sessions to address any questions about the project at the park, at the mobile home park, and at public locations, the nearby Safeway and Fred Meyer store parking lots. We're going to host a bike truck safety event because there are approximately 30,000 truckloads worth of material that are going to be coming out of Palo Butte, and then several thousand truckloads of concrete coming in over the next several years.
So if you could make sure those trucks have those side guards on them, that would be great for bikes.
Well, they won't be our trucks, Mayor, but I will make a note of that, and I think we'll work on that. We're meeting with groups that hold permitted activities inside the park to discuss restrictions. We're doing routine reminders to the public to use alternate routes, and we're staging activities to draw public attention, such as a groundbreaking ceremony and that bike truck safety event. The Palo Butte Master Plan was done through a land use review type 3 process, which is the most stringent. The Master Plan has a list of conditions of approval and development standards that have to be met as part of the project. Type 2 land use review is required to demonstrate how any project on Palo Butte during the 10-year life complies with the requirements of the Master Plan. Type 3 review is required for any work in an environmental protection zone or anything that doesn't meet the requirements for the Type 2 review as defined in the Conditional Use Master Plan. Most of the current project will be included in the Type 2 review. The only work we're expecting to include in the Type 3 review are the emergency overflow structure, the three pipes at Johnson Creek, and some of the trail improvements. All of those are things located in the EP zone. Palo Butte 2 has been in the Water Bureau 5 and 10-year CIP and financial plans since the late 1980s. Construction of the second reservoir on Palo Butte was identified in the system vulnerability study in 1996 as a critical project. The existing reservoir needs to be seismically upgraded, and that work cannot be done until the second reservoir is operational. This project also gives the Water Bureau flexibility in how we comply with the open reservoir portion of the LT2 rule. If we're successful in getting legislative relief from Congress regarding our continued use of the open reservoir, Palo Butte will still be needed and necessary so that reservoir number 1 can be taken offline for 3 years while the seismic retrofitting is done. If we're successful in getting legislative relief on the issue of open reservoirs, Palo Butte 2 will be a project that will serve our water distribution needs for the next 50 to 100 years. If we're not successful, it's the first step in complying with LT2. The Palo Butte 2 Phase 1, the excavation, has been identified as an economic stimulus project. It will be a general grading and excavation type contract with subcontracting opportunities potentially in fencing, erosion control, traffic control, flagging, trucking, and tree removal. The entire project should be completed in 2013. I asked my chief engineer to take a quick run across the street to remind me how many jobs we're projecting will be created as a result of this job, and he told me 1,516 exactly. In a recent letter from Friends of Reservoirs, Floyd Jones wrote that Palo Butte poses quality and logistic problems as it is removed from the service area and prone to producing a stale quality. There is absolutely no basis for that claim. Our average daily usage in the city of Portland is 100 million gallons. On peak days, it can reach 180 million gallons or higher. Every drop of that water goes into Palo Butte first before it goes into our distribution system. There are no water quality problems associated with Palo Butte, nor will this second reservoir create any. To the contrary, temperatures in the reservoir should stay more consistent in a closed reservoir than they would in an open reservoir. There's less likelihood of algae growth in covered reservoirs. We don't anticipate midge flies in covered storage like we've had in our open reservoirs in the past. We can design the new reservoir to improve mixing and improve flow through the structure, which does improve water quality. Water turns over at least twice a day in Palo Butte. It's a 50 million gallon reservoir. We have an average daily flow of 100 million gallons. Do the math. It goes through fairly darn quickly. Water turns over much more slowly in the open reservoirs. Water in Reservoir 6, where most of us get our water, may take several days to turn over. Our biggest water quality problems in our system, from the standpoint of being stale, occur at the farthest reaches of our system, or at the dead ends of our system, or in sections of town like the Industrial East Side, which was sized decades ago for big industrial users, but those industrial users don't exist anymore. So the system's oversized, and the water does tend to create water quality problems because there's too much water sitting there. The preliminary design report for the 50-million-gallon reservoir was completed in 2002. A drainage study for stormwater management was completed in 2006. Since 2003, we've been working on the early projects: the pedestrian path from 162nd Avenue, mitigation plantings, replacement of the dilapidated caretaker trailer, invasive species removal, ADA trail improvements, and bike parking facilities near the restroom. Those were all conditions of approval of the conditional use master plan that had to be completed before we could start the reservoir. These are done, and we're ready to begin. This is the first of two projects to build a reservoir. Phase one is what I've described: excavation, access road improvements, site fencing, erosion control, temporary drainage improvements, trail relocations, temporary parking lots, and tree removal. Phase two is expected to begin in the summer of 2010, and it will include the actual reservoir construction, the piping, the appurtenances, a segment of conduit number 5, emergency overflow pipe and structure, reservoir drain, the relocation of the caretaker's house, the maintenance and storage building in the yard, the restroom remodel, the parking lot improvements, interpretive center, trail improvements, updated trail plan, stormwater improvements, the landscaping, tree replacement, and restoration. Phase one construction costs are estimated at $13.2 million. Total Powell Butte II project costs are estimated to be $138 million total. We've worked with PBOT and Parks and Recreation to develop on-site and off-site traffic control plans. Construction traffic will be using 162nd and Southeast Division. They're both arterial roads with 5 lanes plus. These roads are designed to carry this type of traffic. The only other road impacts would be along the utility corridor southeast of the parking lot. Truck traffic will access the utility corridor from the park and from Circle Avenue, and will be providing traffic control on Endreg Loop, Circle Avenue, and Southeast 174th. The nature park will be open during construction. However, we will be closing the main access road during the excavation because of the volume of construction traffic. As I said, 30,000 truckloads of material. I think we've estimated one truck every couple of minutes. The access road will be open to park users during normal park hours and when the contractor's not working. There will be intermittent closures at other times during construction with advance notice. We've also established alternate sites, including ADA access, for people who want to use the park and other parts of the park that will not be affected even during the construction hours. This project's being done in two phases. Phase one was designed in-house by Portland Water Bureau staff. Phase two is more specialized structural design, and it will be designed by a consultant. Both projects will be constructed by contractors. They'll have opportunities for MWESB subcontractors. I'd be happy to answer any questions if you have them.
Well, I'm just concerned that your report might not have enough detail in it.
I was worried that you might think so.
I will tell you that that's a break from the tradition of my office, but I've reviewed the comments David made. I returned them to him and said, add more detail, because there have been questions raised as to whether or not there's been adequate public process. So I told David, include every step along the way what has been done.
So a lot of outreach.
You may not like the project, but it won't be because there hasn't been adequate public process.
Commissioner Fish.
Why is this an emergency ordinance today?
We would like to get the RFP for the construction out on the street as soon as we can. It is our intent to begin excavation as soon as we are able. We're actually a little behind where we had hoped to be. We had hoped to begin groundbreaking this month. So we would like to get it out as quickly as we can.
And more to the point, the council earlier agreed to move up projects that were otherwise going to be done as part of the stimulus package. This is a shovel dirt-ready project that as soon as we get this out the door, we can start putting people to work.
You know offhand the relative mix of stimulus dollars versus budgeted dollars, city dollars?
It's all budgeted city dollars.
Is there a local stimulus?
I'm sorry, so it's a local stimulus.
Yeah, exactly. There is no federal stimulus money coming to the Water Bureau on this project.
David, you explain, and that was probably the most comprehensive and detailed and thoughtful presentation I can remember in 7 months. And I was trying to follow everything you said, but in the, you know, I'm reminded when someone, you know, you go to a restaurant.
I thought it was a filibuster there for a while.
They tell you the 20 things on the specials, and you say, would you remind me what the fourth one was again? You made a point about that we would need to do this regardless of whether we get the waiver, which I thought was a very important point. And could you just, for my benefit, state that again?
Sure. There are a couple of reasons. The Powell Butte 1, the existing reservoir, was not built to today's seismic standards. It has been a project to retrofit Powell Butte number 1 for years. We cannot do that until Powell Butte 2 exists. Once we have Powell Butte 2, we can actually take our time in deciding when we will retrofit Powell Butte number 1. We would fit it into our CIP when we can and when the dollars are there, because if Powell Butte 1 were to fail, we've got Powell Butte 2 existing. The second piece is that even if the concern has been that if we get a legislative grant to continue using our open reservoirs, all of a sudden we have 50 million gallons of extra storage that we didn't otherwise need. Eventually, we are going to need that storage. We don't need it next year or the year after or the next 10 years. But this is a facility that's going to last 100 years.
Okay, and that's an important point.
And it's cheaper to build it now than it will be 20 years from now.
And so regardless of how one views the LT2 process, the waiver, how we handicap that, you've made an argument.
As a standalone project.
As a standalone. And finally, what are you going to do with all the dirt?
Well, the top layer will be stored at Powell Butte to be put back. The remaining 30,000 truckloads, we've tentatively identified a quarry that's a mile and a half away on, I believe it's Division.
If Parks came to you with a proposal to use some of the dirt to actually level out some fields and help...
If they brought their checkbook, that would not be a problem.
That's coming from the Scrooge administrator. We would happily work with Parks to accommodate them.
We've actually spoken with the commissioner. They've told us of a couple of sites that are fairly nearby that they would like to work with us on.
Including, I think, the soccer complex, for example, at in
Park Rose.
We need to actually raise the level.
It's simply a matter of money, truck mileage, that sort of thing.
But I just wanted to
facetious. We've actually spoken to them. Teresa Elliott, the project manager, has had contact with Parks Bureau staff. There are a couple of places where the Parks Bureau has seriously identified that they would like perhaps some help there.
Okay, thank you.
Other discussion on council? Commissioner Fritz?
Just to follow up on that, are we being paid for putting the dirt into the quarry, or are we paying for disposal?
Commissioner, I don't know. I don't know.
Okay.
Usually we pay to get rid of the dirt, right?
But I've asked David and his staff to look into a variety of projects, including South Waterfront, where the some of the property down there actually needs to be raised, if I recall, 8 inches or 12 inches to see if they will purchase.
Right. Yeah, it's actually I think it's something like 30 feet. They're looking for a lot of fill. So wherever we are going to be able to get rid of the fill the cheapest way, and including actually getting somebody to pay us for it, we are looking at.
Right. Okay.
With the exception of Parks,
or I should say, with the exception of Ross Island.
Parks. Okay.
Ross Island is off the table now. I take it.
So, I thought I heard you just say that there aren't any federal stimulus dollars, but in the ordinance it says that there are. It says that's one of the reasons for it being an emergency ordinance, that it's funded with local, state, and federal economic stimulus program.
It is not federal stimulus. There are no federal stimulus dollars coming to us on this project.
So do we need to move a minor amendment to strike that language?
Well, fearful of doing. It says by the 2009 local, state, and federal economic stimulus program, is this somehow what the council's action was labeled when we made a decision?
You know, I'm going to say yes, because we know that there is no federal dollars coming. There are no federal dollars coming.
This doesn't say federal dollars are coming. No. It says by the 2009 local, state, federal economic stimulus program. So that could be the overreaching. But that could be the overreaching policy the council adopted. I don't know.
I just want to make sure it's tidy.
So do you want to make a motion, Commissioner Fritz? We need to.
You want me to?
I don't think it matters one way or the other.
Okay.
It doesn't identify dollars. It says a program. It could very well be.
I'm happy with it. I just want to make sure it's clean and tidy. And then I just want to make sure that I understand correctly. It's part of this funding is already in the 08-09 budget, and then part of it is in the current rate increase request that you have before.
The lion's share, the $13.2 million. The part about the 08-09 is the work that our project manager, Teresa Elliott, has been working on. So not very much, but the lion's share, that $13.2 million, is in the upcoming proposed 09-10 budget.
Thank you.
All right, any other council discussion with Mr. Schaff? Anyone wishes to testify on council calendar item before us, 317?
No one signed up.
You don't want to testify, Linda? You had a hand in all of the, you should come up and acknowledge your great work.
Welcome to the City Council.
Thank you. Linda Bauer. Actually, I would like to thank Commissioner Fish's office for opening a line of communication for me. Thank you all very much.
All right. If there is no further council discussion, will you please call the roll? Carla.
Mayor, did Commissioner Fritz make a...
No.
Okay. Fritz?
It does seem to me that we need this storage regardless of our discussion this afternoon and that it's been in the works for a long time. I do share the concern that it's an emergency ordinance. I'm wondering why it wasn't brought a month ago, but presumably you've been working on it as fast as you can now that we have things in order. Lots of good work. I want to commend Linda Bauer, the chair of the Pleasant Valley Neighborhood Association, for her leadership in securing the park's improvements in the conditional use approval. And I'm comfortable knowing that the phase two design and construction will go through a type two process to make sure that those things are done, and also knowing that the Water Bureau has every intention of doing that. Also glad to hear you talking about women and minority businesses in the contracting and hope we can increase the proportion that goes to those sources. But a lot of good work on this. And thank you all to the citizens who've sent a lot of input by email on this, which I've read, and I vote aye.
Fish.
Well, I've offered David Schaff a position with the Housing Bureau, and he told me candidly I could not afford him. And after his performance today, when he put up further roadblocks for collaboration with parks, I'm going to withdraw my offer. But I would say that was as... we do a lot of kidding up here to keep things light during very grim times, but that was one of the most thoughtful, comprehensive presentations I've ever heard. I was trying to find some way to turn your obsession with public process into a joke, something like, based on what I've heard, why do you hate the public process part of your job? But I'm surprised you're actually still in this job, given the amount of public process you are required to do in the ordinary course and the scope of your activities. I've, like everyone else up here, received some emails from a very small number of citizens raising concerns. In each and every instance, I've also received a lengthy rebuttal response, either drafted by you or by Commissioner Leonard or both, pointing out a different side of the story, which I will tell you I really appreciate, because in our system of government, by definition, we defer to the commissioner in charge because they have the particular expertise. But it doesn't mean we're immune from getting hit by people that raise concerns and want us, obviously, to get engaged. And when we do get substantive responses that address the concerns that are done respectfully and comprehensively, it makes our job a lot easier. So I want to thank you for that. I know that's an additional piece of your work that I don't know where you find time to do your day job, but we appreciate. you know, I'm satisfied that as a standalone project, this makes sense. I'm pleased that this has been put into our local stimulus package in terms of accelerating our work. And I think you've been extremely thoughtful in looking at all of the pieces, the moving pieces here. So I'm pleased to vote aye.
Saltzman?
Well, I'm pleased to support this. And since I may not be here for this afternoon's work session, I just want to get my perspective out right now on the report that's coming to us at 2:30 or 2. I do have concerns that were raised in our budget discussions, I think by Commissioner Fritz, about the decision of a filtration plant versus a UV ultraviolet radiation.